This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. If you're listening to us on one of the four frequencies that simulcast Indiana Public Radio out of Muncie, you'll recognize our guest as the local host of Morning Edition. Stan Sollers has been at the mic weekday mornings at WBST since 1995.
Yes.
And has been on the faculty at Ball State since the early 90s. Mm-hmm. He recently celebrated 50 years in radio, but we're not here to talk about his career. We're here to talk about the news that he got a little over 5 years ago and the journey his life has taken since then. Stan Sollers, welcome to All In.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I would be remiss if I didn't start by disclosing that Stan taught me at Ball State when I was a student there from 2001 to 2005. So it really is an honor to have you on my show. I just never thought we'd be here. But indeed, here we are, and I'm grateful for it, though the circumstances are less than ideal.
Yes, Mr. Pelser, and I wanted to bring to your attention that paper that you still owe me from 2004.
You know, I found what I started from that, and if I'd known, I would have brought it with me today. If
All right,
I'd known
well,
you would bring it up.
The ink is dry on the diploma, so I think you're safe.
There is a happy ending to this story.
Yes, there
you
is.
Are here, after all, but can you tell us the news you got back in 2014?
Yes, I was diagnosed with stage 3 lower esophageal cancer. And it's one of those cancers that can come up on you and you don't know that you have it. And all of a sudden, there it is. I started having what's called GERD, which is a white, foamy bit of saliva which collects down in the esophagus. I was starting to have some pain in the abdomen, and I thought, well, this just isn't right. So I went to my family physician, went through a couple of protocols there, had a scope, and a tumor was found August 1st of 2014.
Mm. How did that news hit you?
Ton of bricks. But I must say, simultaneously with the shock of that moment, I felt a calm. And from the standing start, I felt that I was going to be fine. I don't know how else to explain it, but just to say that. It's nothing that you want. I'd much rather have gone to the state fair that week, you know. But it's that jolting thing, because I grew up in an era when if you got a cancer diagnosis, you had some real rough road ahead of you, or a short one. And so there was the, oh, goodness, what to do. And thankfully, we got some good guidance, and my wife Allison, who is here today, and can't say enough good about her, you know, she was right in there with me all the way, and to this day is. But you take that news, take a breath, and then say, right, what do we do next?
And we're going to have your doctor, Dr. Jalal, in the next couple of segments to ask her kind of the facts about this cancer. But This struck you in your mid to late 50s?
Yeah, I was 58.
58.
Yeah, I'm 63 today. And I was 58 at the time. And as she can tell us, for American men in their late 50s, this cancer is ramping up just markedly and frighteningly so.
And does that have to do with, I'm sure there are a lot of factors, but say, for lack of a better term, the American diet?
I think that has a lot to do with it. I have no evidence other than my own thoughts. All I can say was that I was sloppy at that time. I mean, charming, of course, but I was sloppy in terms of what I was eating. And I am now at 160.
Svelte.
Thank you. Give or take a couple of pounds. And that's where I should be at 5'9 and 3/8 or whatever I am. And I wasn't. I went up to 251. So I was technically obese. I was having a lot of fun eating. So that was a risk factor, is a risk factor for some cancers. But no one knows how or why I got it, because I didn't drink, don't drink today. Likewise with smoke. I just didn't have any of the stereotypical risk factors that you would associate with it, except, again, for being obese.
And so how soon after the diagnosis did everything start to move toward treatment and things like that?
Well, the scope was done, the initial scope was done in Muncie on August 1st. And wonderful GI doctor there at IU Health Ball Memorial Hospital said, we have to get you to Indianapolis because at the Simon Cancer Center, University Hospital, they have the expertise for that. And indeed, that was heaven sent, if you will, information. And we got connected up with the right doctors. A week later, I had an ultrasound endoscopy, which gave us the first bit of good news. And that was that the cancer had not spread. It was stage 3. So if I can liken this to driving a rally car, I was scraping the guardrail. Because stage 4 means that it has metastasized. The cancer has spread. But thankfully for me, that was not the case. And so there was some hope.
Was there any indication as to how close you might have been to stage 4?
Not that I can recall. All I knew was, and all that Allison knew, was that we were going to fight this. Whatever the outcome, by gosh, we're going to start today. We were scared. This was no tea party, of course.
Of course.
But we took a positive outlook, because I am, in my own nature, a glass half full guy. Allison is the same, you know, glass half full woman. And so we were going, but, you know, it's nothing that you can paint on. It's nothing that you can just pretend, oh, everything's going to be okay, because no, it won't be. But you can have more good than bad. And that was it. I had to put on my horse blinkers, so to speak, you know, those visual partitions that keep the horse focused on just its lane, right? I couldn't think, and it would have been counterproductive to have thought about Charlie's cancer or Sally's cancer. I had to think about my own and pay attention to my own doctors and stay with that plan and surround myself with as many people that were family and friends, and I have lovely family and friends, and then on Facebook, and certainly the radio audience at IPR, WBST at Ball State, and they reached out, too. I couldn't believe it. But all of those, the prayers, the positive thoughts, the vibes, yeah, I felt myself surrounded by that, and that was of incalculable help. And it lifted me up.
And you were recently declared cured, and we'll talk a lot more about that later. Mm-hmm. But what that basically means is free of detectable cancer for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
And so then, the timeline, the math, the way it's working out in my head, when was that declaration made this year?
October 30th.
Okay. So it was October 30th, 2014, when you were free of detectable cancer?
Well, I had surgery on November 21st of 14 by Dr. Ken Kessler, who's one of the top thoracic surgeons on the planet, and he does, at least did at the time, between 70 and 90 of these esophagectomies, as they're called, where I had the bottom half of my esophagus and the top part of my stomach into the clean margins. And I took out obviously the diseased tissue and pulled up the stomach, so it's part of the esophagus now. And so he did that surgery on November 21st. He has lectured all over the world on this and has written in professional as well as academic articles, books and so forth. And I like the fact that he's on the med school faculty.
Right, so that always helps.
Yeah, so being a faculty member, but in terms of audio production, don't get me near blood. Thank you very much. but it felt good to be with compassionate as well as top of their skills professionals and scholarly folks. And Dr. Jalal is also on the med school faculty here. And then Dr. Mark Langer, who's my radiation oncologist, they're all three on the med school faculty, and they communicate. And that's one of the key things. If your doctors do not communicate, regardless of the computer system that the given facility might have, that's two squares back. These three communicate regularly, communicated very much in sync when I was being treated, and that's priceless.
And there's something about Indianapolis. You said when you went mm-hmm. to Ball Memorial, they said, we got to get to Indianapolis.
Right.
And that's not just because we're the big city a couple hours south.
Right.
It's because Indianapolis is where this kind of cancer is best treated, at least in the Midwest.
Yes. And again, Dr. Jalal would be the expert on this, but thankfully, through work at the Glenn Lehman Endoscopy Center, which is part of the Simon Cancer Center at University Hospital, and all of the technicians and staff members and Dr. Muhammad Ali Al-Haddad, I think I got all of it out, or Dr. Mo, as we call him, he was the one who did the ultrasound endoscopy 1 week later, where we got good news that it did not spread. I can tell you that, yes, the positive attitude was buoyed by each one of those doctors. And again, nobody was putting on a happy face saying, oh, everything's going to be fine. No, they gave me accurate information upon which to base good thoughts and feelings and so on. So, no, it was no pleasure cruise by any means. But each step along the way, I was so well cared for. These people are angels.
And you had already, we'll go back to your kind of state of health at that time. You mm-hmm. you were technically obese when the diagnosis happened. But at the mm-hmm. time, luckily for you, you had already sort of begun to turn that around. You recognized
yes.
that as a problem even before you got the cancer diagnosis.
Yes. Allison and I both were heavier than we wanted to be. We had been lighter weight in previous years. And we thought, what are we doing here? So she consulted more or less her second dad up in Fort Wayne, who turned us on to a very good book written by Joel Fuhrman, M.D., Eat to Live, which we see on PBS fundraisers and so on. And he's a very good authority on nutrition and micronutrients and so forth. And the whole idea is to have nutrient-dense foods to help buck up the immune system and help keep all of our systems operating at peak efficiency. So that's what we did. And by the time that I was diagnosed, I had lost 50 pounds. So I was down to around 200, which again, today seems frightful because I'm back to where I should be weight-wise. But you know, I was feeling better, and then this happens. I'm thinking, well, isn't that ironic?
Today we're talking about esophageal cancer. My guest is Stan Sollers, Morning Edition host for Indiana Public Radio, based out of Muncie on the Ball State campus. He was diagnosed in 2014 and has been declared cured since. When we come back, we'll bring Dr. Shadia Jalal from the IU Simon Cancer Center, who specializes in the treatment of esophageal cancer. She's also the physician who treated Stan. We'll talk more about typical warning signs and lifestyle habits that can lead to this kind of cancer and what you can do. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get back to today's show, I want to tell you about what we talked about yesterday. Indiana Humanities has been putting on its Chew on This series, which sits people down to have civil dialogue about big issues in one of the best ways possible, with food. We talked about how to have thoughtful conversations about big issues, even with strangers or family you don't often see, which could be very helpful as we head into the holidays. You can find that show on our podcast feed. Just search for All In, look for our blue and black logo, and be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Back now with Indiana Public Radio's Stan Sollers, who's been Morning Edition host there in East Central Indiana for coming up on 25 years. He's here talking about his tough journey through esophageal cancer, of which he was recently declared cured by his doctor, who also joins us now, Dr. Shadia Jalal of the IU Simon Cancer Center. Dr. Jalal, welcome to All In.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Dr. Jalal, let's get an overview. Who typically gets esophageal cancer?
It's a great question. So, esophageal cancer is, funny enough, a disease that sometimes people actually haven't heard of until they were diagnosed. It's not as famous as breast cancer or lung cancer, but it's actually the eighth most common cancer worldwide, and it is actually the sixth most common cause of cancer death. And by far, men are more likely to get it than women. When we say esophageal cancer, in general, we have to remember that it's two distinct diseases. There's the squamous cell, which is not the type that we should probably talk much about today, simply because it is not the most common kind of esophageal cancer that we see in the United States. The most common by far is esophageal adenocarcinoma, which is what Mr. Sollers had. And that is a disease that has increased dramatically in incidence. And actually, the biggest increase is in men in the age group between 45 and 65 years of age. So most of my patients look like Mr. Sollers. They are white men between the age of 45 and 65, 70 years old.
Mm. And there, as you say, there are a lot of other cancers that get a lot more attention than esophageal cancer. But it's the sixth most common cause of cancer deaths worldwide.
Correct.
And why do you think we aren't talking about esophageal cancer as much as maybe we should?
I think, you know, part of it is lack of awareness, right? Most people don't know that it is one of the, you know, top 10 cancers to talk about. The other reason is really actually quite unclear to me. I think we should be talking about it, especially, you know, when we think about esophageal cancer nowadays in the United States, I always think about tumors in the bottom of the esophagus, top of the stomach, what we call GE junction tumors, gastroesophageal junction tumors. And those tumors have actually dramatically increased in incidence. In the 1970s, we rarely saw these tumors. And nowadays, they are the most common kind of esophageal cancer that we see in Western countries and in the United States. And that's partly due to obesity and overweight. And we're in Indiana, so that tells you this is a big problem. We immediately should be paying attention to it. Partly due to gastroesophageal reflux disease, which is more common in patients that are obese, smoking, and diet that is low in fruits and vegetables. Those four things are actually accounting for 80% of the risk factors to develop esophageal adenocarcinoma. So I think it's actually a disease we should be talking about, because I don't think in any way it is one that is not causing a significant impact.
Stan, I can remember when I first heard about your diagnosis, and you kept all of your Facebook friends in the loop and the saga, myself mm-hmm. included. And I just remember as a broadcaster myself, feeling for you, not just because you're my friend, but because I've had my own worries about something, anything happened to that part of my body, you know, that has so much to do with our line of work, your throat. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you got the diagnosis, how much did that occupy your thoughts?
Not really any at all, because it was way south of there.
Okay. Well, okay, so you had that specific information,
right.
I guess, then.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that it was down in the chest cavity, more or less.
Yeah. The lower thoracic region or wherever, just below the sternum, is where I have an incision from just below the sternum to the top of the navel. So that was the area that was operated on, and another one around the back here. But no, I didn't think about my voice. I was wanting simply to live.
Mm.
And again, I got good information. I was with the top professionals. I don't know how you could top the team that I had down at University Hospital with my quarterback sitting right here, Dr. Jalal, and Dr. Kessler and Dr. Langer. And there are other talented people down there, too, who are very good at this. Indianapolis seems to be one of the top places on the planet where this disease can be treated, and fortunately, it was only 60 miles down the road for me. But no, I did not focus on the voice. I was wanting to take care of Allison and my students, and I said, by gosh, I've got to defeat this. I've got my course assessments to do.
That's a very Alex Trebek sort of attitude.
Well, yeah. Because that's the important thing. Yes, cancer is a full-time job for which you do not get paid, but which you pay.
Quite a bit.
And so, yes, that is an occupied bit of time. And so we had that, but I also kept busy with work. Not to ignore, because I pride myself on being compliant. Mistakes, yes, but I try to be very compliant. Because I was fighting for my life. And, yeah, it did get a bit tentative at times, the thoughts. But no, for the most part, I really felt like I was going to be fine. And Again, it was backed up by good scientific information.
Dr. Jalal.
So your question is actually really important, but I just wanted to highlight that, you know, most people that have a tumor in the distal esophagus or top of the stomach or that GE junction, they don't present with like voice hoarseness. It's not like throat cancer. The most common symptom is actually what we call dysphagia or odynophagia. And actually, Mr. Sollers had that, which is, you know, suddenly you notice that you're having trouble with food. You have to soften your diet. I hate saying it, but I see men that look extremely strong and everything, and they end up kind of eating baby food. It's quite traumatizing to live and quite traumatizing to watch, honestly. It hurts when they eat or they swallow. Even though a lot of patients have probably previously had acid reflux, sometimes they never really notice the symptoms of acid reflux, but they start noticing it when you have that tumor ulcerating mass in the esophagus. So suddenly you're having that indigestion that won't go away. You're losing weight, as Mr. Sollers mentioned. So most of the time you're not presenting with voice hoarseness, because most esophageal tumors that we see in the U.S., like I said, are not the squamous that would present with some of those symptoms, but are rather the adenocarcinomas that are more in the distal part of the esophagus.
And as I understand it, this sort of chronic acid reflux, this sort of condition is not normal. And a lot of people who I think have it just treat it symptomatically with antacids and things like that. Why is that not such a great idea?
Well, I would say, you know, having persistent acid reflux, meaning you feel it a lot, two times a week in some studies or more, or it is severe in degree. Sometimes patients, you know, end up in the emergency room. They think they have a heart attack when what they really had is an episode of acid reflux. And then having long-standing acid reflux, meaning you have it for decades. Most studies suggest more than 20 years. Those are risk factors for what we call Barrett's esophagus, which is a precancerous condition that could increase your risk of developing esophageal cancer. Barrett's esophagus is basically you've got normal-looking cells. They're just in the wrong place. Suddenly, the lining of your esophagus looks like the lining of your colon or the lining of your stomach. And that is thought to potentially be our body's way to adapt to the severe, persistent, long-standing acid reflux. So a lot of patients, probably 50% of people that have esophageal cancer, have had some kind of acid reflux that has been symptomatic. But there's another half that haven't. Also, acid reflux is not always indigestion. You know, sometimes it's a chronic cough. Acid reflux gets diagnosed by ear, nose, and throat doctors at times, where they look at your vocal cords and they notice that you've got acid reflux. And at times it's frequent throat clearing or voice hoarseness. So it's not always the typical, I have reflux going up my chest kind of deal. So I would say, you know, having some degree of acid reflux is part of being alive, right? But if you're having severe acid reflux, you're having persistent acid reflux, you're feeling it multiple times a week, you should definitely be seen by a gastroenterologist. And you might need some acid reflux medicine, but then you potentially at some point in time should get an endoscopy and figure out, do I have that inflammation in my esophagus? Because it's chronic inflammation that it increases your risk of developing that cancer.
We're talking about esophageal cancer with Dr. Shadia Jalal and a patient of hers, Indiana Public Radio's Stan Sollers. Dr. Jalal, I'm curious because I'm not asking you to treat me or diagnose me or anything, but I'm simply bringing it up for the sake of the conversation. I had an interesting episode recently where I had chest pains. And I was worried that that might be heart-related. I've never had problems like that before, but it did not feel like heartburn. But I went to the doctor, had an EKG, found out it was nothing, and then found out that it was indeed heartburn. It doesn't always feel the same, does it?
That's true. Again, we use the term acid, but it's not always acidic. And it's not only from your stomach. You know, there's duodenal, so small bowel things that go up, things that come from your biliary tree that go up. Acid reflux, if you study it, it's very heterogeneous. It depends on your meal and what you ate. And so just like the contents of it and the biology of it is different, it's possible that your symptoms at times might feel different as well.
Stan, you were lucky in a lot of ways, but one that seems pretty significant is that you had a great caregiver in your wife, Allison, who it sounds like was really, she really kind of took the bull by the horns from the outset, which isn't always easy to do emotionally. How important was it to have a great caregiver?
Oh, it's everything, really, when you get right down to it from an emotional standpoint. She slept 8 nights in a chair in my room at University Hospital. I was there for 8.5 days, and part of which was in intensive care, which is the procedure at University Hospital, Simon Cancer Center. And she was – it was just reassuring to me to know that she was there. I – like I said, I truly believed that I was going to be fine, and she reinforced that. And we kept a good humor going. We joked as much as possible. There were times when, because I was on so many medications, that I was not my regular Julie Andrews or Mr. Rogers self. And she would just be such a trooper through those periods and reassure me, let alone look out for what food we were going to eat once I could again consume. Because Thanksgiving dinner in 2014 for me was an 8-ounce glass of water.
Oh my goodness! Really?
Yeah. And I was glad to have that.
Of course.
Oh my! Yeah, because one is without food or water after the procedure for 7 days, and I was of course hydrated by IVs, but boy, that was a challenge just to keep my mouth and throat wet, and quite hard to do. But oh, the results were fabulous.
Dr. Jalal, was Stan's a typical case?
In many ways, yes, because as I mentioned, he's a male, he's white, he was in the age group that you would expect. And, you know, when he was diagnosed, kind of the stage he was diagnosed with, which is what we would call a stage 3 or a locally advanced esophageal cancer, that's the most common stage we diagnose patients at. So, his presentation, the symptoms he presented with in many ways were typical of a patient with esophageal cancer.
Mm-hmm. Was his treatment regimen also typical?
Yes, I would say. You know, he might have mentioned, but he got a combination of chemotherapy with radiation. Esophageal cancer is not highly radiation sensitive on its own. You have to give something to sensitize your tumor to radiation. So, you know, he received chemotherapy that helped sensitize his tumor and the surrounding lymph nodes that were radiated to radiation. And of course, the goal of chemotherapy was to, if God forbid he had any small micro metastases or small cancer cells floating in the bloodstream, to kill them with chemotherapy. So he got a combination of chemotherapy with radiation, and this was followed by an esophagectomy, as he mentioned, at a center where you have surgeons that have done many of these surgeries, because this is definitely not a surgery that you want to get done unless it's in a large academic center with a lot of experience. And he had a great response to his chemotherapy and radiation, which perhaps is kind of your biggest indicator of what his survival is going to be like. If I recall correctly, 19 or so lymph nodes were removed. None of them had cancer. So what you find at the time of surgery, how many positive lymph nodes you have post chemotherapy and radiation, directly tells you what are your chances of being cured. And in his case, thank God, all his lymph nodes were negative. And so in many ways, he was an extremely proactive person. Like, he talked about diet. He really stuck to a healthy diet. He was not smoking, which is a huge thing, because if you're an active smoker, you're going to do worse with surgery. You're going to have more side effects to radiation. Your outcomes, regardless of what cancer you have, what stage it is, or what treatment you receive, your outcomes are a lot worse if you are an active smoker. So he was not doing that. So that was really important. And he actually continued to try to exercise, which was also extremely important to fight cancer fatigue, chemo fatigue, reduce the chances of neuropathy or numbness and tingling related to chemotherapy. So he honestly did everything right. He made my job easy, to be honest, or easier. And so I think, you know, in many ways, there is just a lot to learn from his journey and his experience and how he handled it.
And this is a case of stage three. Is surgery almost always necessary in this stage or even prior stages, stages one or two?
It's a great question. So most stage one esophageal cancers are treated with surgery. Most stage twos are treated with a combination of chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And the same goes for stage three. As I mentioned, he had esophageal adenocarcinoma, and it's actually, our standard of care, I hate saying it, but is based on limited evidence. So just to give you an example, most esophageal trials didn't just include adenocarcinoma. They actually included adeno and squamous. A squamous of the esophagus is not related to reflux. As I mentioned, is not common in the United States, is related to alcohol and smoking, is highly more sensitive to chemotherapy and radiation. It is a different disease. In fact, the only thing that is in common between a squamous of the esophagus and an adenocarcinoma of the esophagus is that they are in the esophagus. But a squamous of the esophagus looks more on a genomic level, like a head and neck cancer. An esophageal adenocarcinoma looks more like a stomach cancer on a genomic level. And unfortunately, for decades, those two were lumped together. So trials included both of these. And that tells you that we are studying two different diseases at the same time. And that really has limited our ability to actually define the best treatment for esophageal adenocarcinomas. The field is shifting, and I think we are going to learn a lot more about the right way to treat each of those two cancers. But unfortunately, so far, our standard of care is not necessarily based on the most scientifically planned clinical trials.
We're talking with Dr. Shadia Jalal, an oncologist who specializes in esophageal cancer at the IU Simon Cancer Center, and a patient of hers, Stan Sollers, who also hosts Morning Edition at one of our affiliates, Indiana Public Radio, based out of Muncie. More with them next. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back talking about esophageal cancer with Dr. Shadia Jalal of the IU Simon Cancer Center and one of her patients, who you've definitely heard before if you're listening to us on Indiana Public Radio out of Muncie. Morning Edition host Stan Sollers, who was recently declared cured of the disease. Stan, we were just talking about separating adenocarcinoma and, forgive me,
squamous cell.
Squamous cell, which is are two very different forms of esophageal cancer.
You got it.
And we were talking a little bit during the break about the importance of not Googling.
Oh, yeah. Resist that temptation, because there is so much garbage out on the internet. What comes in with the electronic tide is not necessarily helpful. So this is why I would urge anyone that is fighting this particular form of cancer or any form is to please don't Google, because you're not going to get proper data. Follow a wise doctor's guidance, and we hope that wise doctor is your doctor, because they have the information that you need. Because I made the mistake once.
And never again.
And never again. It had some sort of ridiculously low survival rate. But okay, that's enough of that. And that's not what I've been hearing from my doctors on this. Yes, there are risks and so forth.
Dr. Jalal, how often do you have to tell patients that? Don't Google. Don't look this up.
I think even if I was to say it as a physician, it's a very hard thing to resist. I think what I always say is, please feel free to email me. Please ask me, whether it is, you know, CBD oil or vitamin C or whatever it is. I am here to help you. I'm happy to answer those questions. You see a clinical trial you think you might qualify for, please shoot me an email, share that link, and I will let you know whether it works for you or not. So I think the most important thing is to ask those questions. You want to know survival or any of that stuff? You should ask that to your doctor, because as Mr. Sollers mentioned, you know, esophageal cancer is very heterogeneous. Patient factors widely make a difference. A stage 3B and a 4A are not the same. And it's going to be very hard for you as a patient to figure all those things out. That's why people go to med school for 13 years and do residency and fellowship and all of that. So please just don't hesitate to ask those questions, because that's what cancer doctors are there for.
And one of the reasons I paid attention to Dr. Jalal is not only is she at the top of her game, but she started medical school at age 17. So I figured, well, she must know a thing.
I was a boring teenager, clearly.
No, not at all. No.
Stan, part of your treatment was surgery, and it's major surgery. It's thoracic surgery. And I understand that beyond the physical recovery, there's an odd side effect of thoracic surgery. What is that?
Well, again, I don't have any statistics. Perhaps Dr. Jalal could back me up on the numbers somehow. But I did have post-traumatic stress. There's something about thoracic surgery, something on this meridian, if you will, right up the middle of the chest, for my layman's terms there, that seems to affect the psyche or something in the nervous system somehow, because I would have these spells of sadness, and they would come on like a sudden spring rainstorm and then stop as quickly as they started. I didn't do that when I was on the air. I didn't do that in front of my students. You know, these waves would hit me. And so I took to counseling. So I got a therapist and worked through some of these things, knowing that it's a fairly normal procedure, because the aftercare question is one that would be a subject for another show. Mm. The care that I got at university, at Simon Cancer Center, how could they have done it better? I don't know. They were fabulous in all aspects. Pain management, everything. But yet, you know, when we get home, yes, I know that I've got a follow-up appointment and we're checking out all the physicality and so on. And what about the emotional? What about the spiritual? And so this is where you are on the battlefield one day, because this is a war that you fight to survive. And then the surgery is successful. The battle has been won. Perhaps the war has been won. Now you win the peace by taking care of yourself and do the follow-up appointments.
Dr. Jalal, is that pretty common, a pretty common reaction?
You know, I think so. So honestly, after any major surgery, right? So think I just had a major surgery. I mean, comes sleep disturbances, depression, potentially things similar to post-traumatic stress disorder. And then imagine you had a major surgery for cancer, right? And you still don't know. The unknown is very scary. I don't know if I'm cured or not. And because we still in the cancer field are not 100% sure how to determine whether you have any residual disease or not. Are you going to be cured or not? We obviously can't tell that to patients. And so we say, well, things look really good, but we have to keep watching. If you're 5 years out, then we can tell you that you're cured. And I can't imagine, you know, having to wait for every scan and that. If I see people every 3 months, that week before, they're nervous and, you know, their blood pressure has gone up. And the day of the scan, they don't want to even tell me how they're doing until I walk into the room and tell them their scan is clean. I mean, so the unknown will bring fear, will bring depression, will bring anxiety. And, you know, this we're doing more in the cancer field, kind of learning about survivorship and what survivors need in the pediatric field. They've done that a lot better than we have. I think there we still have a lot of work to do to actually support survivors better. But I in no way think that what Mr. Solers has gone through is unusual. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest things in esophageal cancer and in other diseases, whether it's lung cancer or so on, is to really figure out, does the patient have any residual disease? Are they likely to be cured or not? Do they need more treatment or not? When should we stop their treatment? The more we can do on a biological level to actually figure out who is cured and who isn't, the better we will be able to support people and hopefully treat or prevent depression, anxiety, and reassure them about their outcomes.
We're talking with Dr. Shadia Jalal, an oncologist at IUCAM and Simon Cancer Center, about esophageal cancer. We're also here with one of her patients, Stan Solers, whose voice you'll recognize from Indiana Public Radio out of Muncie. Dr. Jalal, I want to follow up on Stan's optimism, his outlook, his attitude? And I know you're a physician, and so you take a very scientific approach to treatment and everything. But how important is that to the recovery and the treatment process?
I think it's important. You know, I think when people are positive and when they try to maintain some normalcy in their life and let cancer destroy it all, like how he continued to work and things like that, be busy-minded, hopefully not sit there and dwell on things, hopefully be a little less depressed, a little less nervous. I think being proactive, I think all of those things do help you emotionally, help your recovery. So I think that is, those are things that we cannot obviously underestimate the importance of. Having said that, you know, at times they're honestly hard to do. Not all of us are optimistic people. And so at times this is just a hard thing to reverse.
You're on the radio in Muncie, Stan, and you kept listeners up to speed on your treatment as well and your recovery. What did you do there?
We did, and I was somewhat reluctant, but I was easily persuaded to do this because I wanted to get the word out about this disease. So my station management at the time said, why don't you do a feature series, a self-narrated series, short bits that we could do during Morning Edition called Stan's Journey. And we had that on air as well as on a podcast for well over a year. And I said, okay, we'll do this only if I can do it in the spirit of trying to help somebody. Because after all, in broadcasting, that's what we're about, especially public broadcasting. And we got responses. There were five people that were afflicted with the disease and diagnosed. Three have passed. Two are still with us. And so I was told that at least with those who have passed, that the days that they had were made better because they were able to see the doctors that I had seen or had said, yeah, you know, I really need to go and do something for somebody. Because if we're feeling low, the best thing we can do, I think, is to try to do something for somebody else, whether it's opening a door or calling somebody that you've not spoken with for some time. Some little bit of kindness that helps the rotation of the earth just go a little bit better for everybody. And so God bless them. But I was honored to be a small, small part of their lives.
Dr. Jalal, when you and I talked before this interview, you said something about esophageal cancer being one of the smartest cancers. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
So we measure smartness, and that's just a way to simplify things, basically by how mutated. When you look at a cancer cell or you look at a tumor, you sequence it and you try to see how many mutations, how many genetic abnormalities are there in a cell. The more, the smarter, basically. So, you know, the top five most mutated tumors, and many cancers have been sequenced. We've been doing this for quite a few years. If you look at them, it's lung cancer, melanoma, esophageal cancer, and bladder cancer. And what is in common with all between all of these is that they are somehow induced by a carcinogen. So lung cancer and bladder cancer, the main risk factors for these are smoking. Melanoma, it's ultraviolet light exposure to sun. Esophageal cancer, it's acid reflux, which, as I mentioned, is a carcinogen, is damaging the DNA of the cell, even changing the lining of your esophagus to a different kind of cell, which is what Barrett's esophagus is. And of course, esophageal cancer's risk is also increased by obesity, which is another rising risk factor for cancer in general. And of course, smoking increases the risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma a bit as well. So that's what's in common with them. And because these are tumors that develop after decades of DNA damage induced either by smoking, ultraviolet light, or acid reflux, these cancer cells are extremely intelligent. They are very mutated. esophageal cancer is really tricky. If you look at the primary tumor and then the lymph node where the cancer metastasized or another organ, like if it went to the liver, and you look at those tumors and you genomically try to characterize them, you notice that they're not identical. It's heterogeneous. And so you might be targeting a gene in the primary tumor, and that gene isn't really playing a role in the metastatic tumor. So that further complicates how do we develop those targeted treatments, what genes matter when and where. So yes, it definitely is one of the top smart cancers.
And Dr. Jalal Stan was recently declared cured of esophageal cancer. What does that mean? How rare of an outcome is that?
I would say it's not rare. So, you know, if people present with metastatic esophageal cancer, meaning it has gone to another organ like liver or bone or lung, the chance of cure is low. The chance of 5-year survival is unfortunately less than 10%. But if people present with locally advanced, meaning it went to the lymph nodes, which is kind of his what happened in his case, probably 40, 45% of them or so are cured. Now, again, this is a general number. It really depends on how many lymph nodes you have. He didn't have any positive lymph nodes after chemotherapy and radiation, so his chance of cure was higher. It was closer to 50, 55, maybe even a little higher. So it really kind of varies based on lymph node status.
Stan, you say that you owe your recovery and good outcome to a lot of people. Among them is a local organization, which is actually right across the street from our studios here in Indianapolis. What was that organization? How did they help?
Well, Little Red Door in Muncie, which is now part of the Indianapolis Little Red Door, supplied us with some liquid nutrition that is a commercial product. Refrain from the brand name here. And that helped me to sustain because I was on a liquid-only diet once I was diagnosed because there was no room for the food to proceed because the tumor was blocking the bottom of the esophagus. And so they, Little Red Door, supplied that, which was very important, no question about it. And also 5 years ago, gasoline was through the roof price-wise. And, of course, our car, as charming as it is, had to use premium. So that was around $4 plus a gallon. And so they had gasoline cards, which they would give. And, you know, I've proven for 50 years in broadcasting how not to make money in this business. And in public broadcasting, that's I'm glad to be here, but you know what I mean. So, the help was essential. And so I can't thank them enough. And so anything that we can do to support Little Red Door in whatever way, whether it's time, talents, or resources of funds, please do so, because there are a lot of folks who are worse off than Allison and I. And could they use the financial help, which certainly helped to get us through that month of 28 consecutive weekdays of radiation. Mm-hmm. And we drove down from Muncie. We had friends from here who drove up to Muncie to drive us down and drive us back and then come back home to Indianapolis. And so it was definitely a team effort, and Little Red Door was part of that.
Dr. Jalal.
Actually, I agree. It's a great organization. I'll tell you, they also have some exercise classes and some yoga and things like that that are, I think, very important for patients that are going through cancer or cancer treatment. So I really echo Mr. Soller's comments. I frequently refer people to it. My social worker gives information about it. And I think it is a great local organization that we should really value.
Yes, and we have to keep living our lives. I mean, we can choose to keep living our lives, I should say. And I chose to do so. And whatever the outcome, and I thank God for the outcome that I had. That was a close one. And it's scary to reflect back on it. But keep living. If you can, do keep working, of course, with your doctor's guidance. And I was told to keep working. And by gosh, I did. They would have had to have chain the doors. You know, I would have been there, and thankfully I was. I was supposed to have taken a month off of work, and I did. And the first day I could get back was a few days before Christmas, back on Morning Edition, and I was there. And all of these support systems helped to make that possible. Little Red Door, family, friends, doctors, of course, and all the countless technicians and nurses who we may never see again, but I would love to go back and say, hey, thank you. that all helped.
I want to thank you both for joining us. Stan Sollers, host of Morning Edition on Indiana Public Radio out of Muncie. I'm so happy for the great news you received recently, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you, man. It's nice to see a former student turn out so well.
And Dr. Shadia Jalal, oncologist with the IU Simon Cancer Center. Thanks for all you've done and all you'll continue to do to fight esophageal cancer.
Thank you. I'm just grateful that Mr. Sollers shared his story and is raising awareness about a disease that I obviously care deeply about.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast is available wherever you get podcasts. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk about charter school operators, school districts, and the State Board of Education. A lot is happening with troubled schools in Indianapolis and Gary, Indiana right now. We'll go over the details and the complicated history behind them with education reporter Eric Weddle. Until then, I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.